My name's John Fish, and this is that second of the series on called The Helping Professions Hurt, and this one dealing, as Jody said, with how the helping professions destroy community. He originally urged I make it into a question, do they, and I said, well, let's discuss that later. First, let's discuss how they do it. See, yesterday we talked about why the helping professions are dangerous, and it was my contention that behind the mask of love and care and service, the helping professions are dangerous precisely because they rob people of the capacities to help themselves and each other. Furthermore, the professional service becomes a substitute for politics and in many cases a denial of authentic care. And it turns people into clients and care into a commodity. Now, today, and I hinted at this yesterday, I contend that professional service destroys community. I want to begin by reading a 5 minutes of about 3 pages of a paper by John McKnight, whom I referred to yesterday. And the paper is entitled John Deere and the Bereavement Counselor. And it came to my mind again because when I asked you yesterday what your grandfathers did, most of you said they were farmers. And then I found out most of you are therapists. So I thought McKnight's paper, John Deere and the Bereavement Counselor, would be appropriate to consider. He begins by describing how inhospitable the prairie was to the European settlers. The cast iron plows just would not cut through the tangled, matted prairie. Where it did, the wet sod would stick to the cast iron plowshares. And so the settlers were sort of stymied. And in 1837, a young blacksmith named John Deere invented a new tool, the steel plow, which, like Teflon, would slide through the earth, cut it up. And, shortly thereafter, the government forced the Sauk Indians off the land, and with disregard for the way that things had been farmed for centuries and ignoring the traditional ways of the Sauk, once the Indians were gone, they plowed up the prairie. And within 30 years, that area became a desert as the soil was totally depleted year by year. And these farmers moved on. And generations later, they began to use that same land for sod and for cattle grazing and other things, dairy. And McKnight continues that. It took the Europeans and their new technology just one generation to make their homeland into a desert. The Sauk Indians, who knew how to sustain themselves on the Sauk prairie land, were banished to another kind of desert called a reservation. And even they forgot about the techniques and tools that had sustained them on the prairie for generations unrecorded. And that was how it was that 3 deserts were created: Wisconsin, the reservation, and the memories of a people. A century later, the land of the Sauk is now populated by the children of a second wave of European farmers who learned to replenish the soil through the regenerative powers of dairying, ground cover crops, and animal manures. These third and fourth generation farmers and townspeople do not realize, however, that a new settler is coming soon with an invention as powerful as John Deere's plow. The new technology is called bereavement counseling. It is a tool forged at the Great State University, an innovative technique to meet the needs of those experiencing the death of a loved one, a tool that can process the grief of the people who now live on the prairie of the Sauk. As one can imagine, the final days of the village of the Sauk Indians before the arrival of the settlers with John Deere's plow, one can also imagine these final days before the arrival of the first bereavement council at Prairie du Sauk. In these final days, the farmers and the townspeople mourn at the death of a mother, brother, son, or friend. The bereaved is joined by neighbors and kin. They meet grief together in lamentation, prayer, and song. They call upon the words of the clergy and surround themselves in community. It is in these ways that they grieve and then go on with life. Through their mourning, they are assured that the bonds between them and renewed, in, they are assured of the bonds between them and renewed in the knowledge that this death is a part of the past and the future of the people on the prairie of the Sauk. Their grief is common property, an anguish from which community draws strength and gives the bereaved the courage to move ahead. It is into this prairie community that the bereavement counselor arrives with the new grief technology. The counselor calls the invention a service and assures the prairie folk of its effectiveness and superiority by invoking the name of the great university while displaying a diploma and certificate. At first, we can imagine that the local people will be puzzled by the bereavement counselor's claims. However, the counselor will tell a few of them that the new technique is merely to assist the bereaved community at the time of death. To some other prairie folk who are isolated or forgotten, the counselor will offer help in grief processing. These lonely souls will accept the intervention, mistaking the counselor for a friend. For those who are penniless, the counselor will approach the county board and advocate the right to treatment for these unfortunate souls. This right will be guaranteed by the board's decision to reimburse those too poor to pay for counseling services. There will be others schooled to believe in the innovative new tools certified by universities and medical centers who will seek out the bereavement counselor by force of habit. And one of these people will tell a bereaved neighbor who is unschooled that unless his grief is processed by a counselor, he will probably have major psychological problems in later life. Several people will begin to use the bereavement counselor because since the county board now taxes them to ensure access to the technology, they will feel that to fail to be counseled is a waste of their money and to be denied a benefit or even a right. Finally, one day, the aged father of a Sauk woman will die and the next door neighbor will not drop by because he doesn't want to interrupt the bereavement counselor. The woman's kin will stay at home because they have learned that only the bereavement counselor knows how to process grief the proper way. The local clergy will seek technical assistance from the bereavement counselor to learn the correct form of service to deal with guilt and grief. And the grieving daughter will know that it is the bereavement counselor who really cares for her because only the bereavement counselor comes when death visits this family on the Prairie du Sauk. It will be only one generation between the time the bereavement counselor arrives and the community of mourners disappears. The counselor's new tool will cut through the social fabric, throwing aside kinship, care, neighborly obligations, the community ways of coming together and going on. Like John Deere's plow, the tools of bereavement counseling will create a desert where a community once flourished. And finally, even the bereavement counselor will see the impossibility of restoring hope in clients once they are generally alone with mourning nothing but a service once they are genuinely alone with nothing but a service for consolation. In the inevitable failure of the service, the bereavement counselor will find the desert even in herself. Which, conclusion, which I suppose is where so many people are who become disillusioned with some of the service professions, that they find the desert in themselves. The question he poses, of course, does the therapist create a desert where once a community flourished? Once we had community, now we have a wide range of therapies. Point we're saying is that professionalized services disable people. Repeat what I said yesterday, the problem is you, you have a problem, and I am your help. So, your health is in the hands of your doctor, right? And your education is in the hands of your teacher. And your safety is in the hands of the police. And your mental health is in the hands of the psychiatrist. And your family stability is in the hands of your marriage counselor. And your free time is in the hands of some recreational planner. And your grief is in the hands of the bereavement counselor. And your salvation is in the hands of the minister. Then who are you? What's left? You become incapacitated because all that you are for yourself and for each other has been slowly taken in the hands of a professional service, which we say that we need. And pointing out yesterday that our economy needs to have people go into these because we no longer need people to make things. So who are you? There is no community. You are no longer bound together with a network of family and friends and neighbors in essential ways, sustaining and supporting life for each other. The tasks of community, tasks that draw upon the capacity of citizens, have been usurped. And thus the contention that professionalized helpers destroy community. Let me take a couple of illustrations. I'm picturing the city of Chicago on the west side 50 years ago. There was a county hospital that wasn't in too good a shape, but it was surrounded by a flourishing community. Neighborhoods that had institutions and stores and various ethnic groups lived, and it was a vibrant neighborhood. Now, you have around that hospital 7 other hospitals and probably 20 auxiliary medical related institutions, the largest medical center in the United States, the Westside Medical Center, 4 schools, 8 hospitals, 18 institutions, flourishing, surrounded by dead or dying neighborhoods. Once we had flourishing neighborhoods and small or inadequate institutions, now in the city we have fantastic institutions, large universities, and destroyed communities. There is, in the south side, a community called Woodlawn that when I was there, 63rd Street, had stores, there was a bank, there was coffee shops, there was a neighborhood newspaper office. People were in and out of 63rd Street all the time. There was a community neighborhood economy and a community center. Now 63rd Street has those storefronts housed, the branch office of Children and Family Services, the Joint Youth Development Commission, the Welfare Office, the Department of Health, a Child Health Center, Unemployment Office, the Department of Public Aid Office, branch offices of downtown service centers. So where you once had a thriving community with its own internal economy and supports, now you have thriving service institutions, adequately paid professionals, and a destroyed community. It seems that the correlation between the thriving services and the destruction of communities go hand in hand. So as we get into it, let me contrast two worlds. One world is the world of institutions. It's the world we all know where there are institutions. And individuals in those institutions. And these are the worlds where jobs are. These we're talking about universities and government bureaucracies and agencies and health systems. And These are all the helping institutions. And there's another, and there are two parts of this world, the institution and the individual. What is left out of this model? Another world. The other world. I want to talk about the other world. Here in the other world are communities, associations. And those are the world of family. That's the world where we worship, the world where we raise children. It's the world of family and friends and neighbors and clubs and civic groups and local unions and local enterprise and ethnic associations. Sometimes it's called the informal sector. It's called the unmanaged sector, the associational. It's the land of the local. Time to look at these two worlds. Because here, what are some of the characteristics? Here, we are governed by pretty much bureaucratic, hierarchical decisions. Here there are bosses, and over here we are guided more by consent. Over here in the other world, it's quick to respond to crises. This world can't respond because everything has to go through channels. Over in the other world, it's face-to-face relationships. In the other world, it's guided, often shaped by our competencies, and we find many people with competency. In the institutional world, it's a world of certification. The other world, I think, is the world of care, real care, where people share with each other. In this world, there are things like Medicare, Judicare, everything that has the word care at the end of it on the side of their truck. Something care, this care. Institutionalized care. Here is the world of communication where words are exchanged and you talk to each other. What are the words here? I think what Knight called uniquack. where every agency has its internal language. In this other world, you get to know people by stories. Here you get to know people by studies. There was a contrast I faced for a number of years because I was at the University of Chicago doing graduate work, and I spent most of my time in the neighboring black community called Woodlawn. And Woodlawn was filled with stories, fascinating, heroic, exciting stories. And all the University of Chicago was interested in was studies, counting people, doing chi-squares of whatever those things are, a statistical analysis. And so the difference between stories and studies, between talking and uniquack, revealing capacities and serving deficiencies. In this other world, there's tragedy and death. In this world, institutional world, there are scientific breakthroughs to extend life 6 more months. The other world begins to solve problems, people's problems. This institutional world creams off the easy problems. And those of you who are into social services know that most institutions do take the easy problems. Any kind of rehabilitation program, they'll take the easy problems, the hard ones they'll send back to the community or put into institutions. Social services always take the easy problems and leave them. So the hard problems are really dealt in the other world where people talk to each other as people. Okay, I say that institutional systems grow at the expense of community. As institutions gain power, communities lose their potency. The consent of community is replaced by the control of institutions. Care in a community is replaced by service of institutions. Citizens become clients. So our role then as citizens and in communities is traded for our right as clients to be served by institutions. And the more we have in this area, the more it is an eclipse of community. Now, each of us, of course, has, a foot in both worlds. But we can act on the premise that the most important part of you is not your location here, and not your MA or PhD or ministry degree or certificate, which places you here, and not your job position. The important part of you is your location here, in your family, in a church, in association, in the local. For in the local is where, in this other world, is where we have stories and we have singing. And we sing songs about justice and not about markets. And about neighbors and not about managers. And about responsibility and not about certification. And about diversity and not about unicrack. And about death, he's saying, and not about scientific breakthrough. So, if we can remind ourselves that this is the important world. Now we can hear, what is this world saying to us? Basically, it is saying to us, we don't want your help. It said, what I want, they say, I need from you, says, I hear the other world saying, everything that gives you power. That's all I want. You can have the rest. So, they say, give us that authority, that legitimacy, access to resources, we will solve problems, we will counsel, we will help each other. Now, let me conclude this for those of you who are preachers, and even if not, for a text for a later sermon. It's John 15, verse 15, where Jesus says, no longer do I call you servants, for the servant does not know what the master is doing, but I have called you friends. Christians who know what the master is doing are called friends, not servants. And it is in an association of friends and not the work of professional servants that communities depend. It's almost like this other world we're living in right now in Holden for a bit. And we all come where our other foot is and where the foot that brings us all the income and a lot of the promotions and the other world beyond the hill is the world of professional service. So I just leave us with that problem and the contention that it's not quite as easy as we might like to see it, because it's this world we are in most of our time isn't just benign, it is destructive of the community, and we must recognize that if we're to begin to deal with the recovery. Okay, let's go. Go ahead.
Just a few comments. I find your talk very interesting. I think, to me, it seems a little oversimplified because, for example, if you take a problem like long-term care, I think the institutions that have grown up in long-term care in this country are not some sort of independent thing that's all by itself that's sort of destroying community, but it is a reflection. It is what we have made it. It is what we have allowed, encouraged. In some ways, it's what we have. You go further, we have a larger percentage of our older population in nursing homes than, say, in a Scandinavian country where they have support systems for the caregiver. And I think that's partly because of the different family decisions that have been made, that we don't take care of mom and pop like we used to. And that isn't an evil institution necessarily coming in and taking them out of the home. The institution came after the family decision. I'm oversimplifying this on myself, obviously. There are many reasons why that's happened. But my point is that the institution is a reflection of our society to some extent.
That's a point. You're saying that in our society, for a variety of reasons, there have been a breakdown of community and communal ties. And the growth of institutions are the response to this breakdown. If we don't have families in one, then we'll have to have institutions. And that we really are caring because these things have disappeared. McKnight's story, in my case, reversed that. It said, the breakdown of community has been largely because of the extension and overextension of services. But that, at least we see the difference, and I think it's an interesting one.
I'm with you on this notion that in my work I see the whole notion of bereavement and grief and stuff. I see it at the older people in the congregation that I serve, and I'm a little nervous to use that word, but I see the older people, and they know when somebody dies how to bring a casserole over. But I don't see that necessarily happening among my generation, that we know how to do that or feel that instantaneous call. There's got to be a casserole over there. Of course, that's just how you do it. But what I'm struggling with, and you're sort of answering that already, for me, in the community in which I'm a part, transience is just a tremendous problem. And so I kind of have a question about which came first, the egg or the chicken, which you're suggesting is probably the institutional thing is the one that's causing that kind of transience that's breaking down community. But then how do we reverse that is a question that I have, because I know we start, I'm a part of a few communal efforts, child care co-op and stuff like that, but you really pay when you have such constant turnover, because then you don't keep those stories. You don't have a history to draw on because nobody knows it. And I don't know how to stop that. You can start little communities around, but they're inevitably transient.
Okay, regardless of which one, I mean, we're both describing the same thing because we've seen it, and I remember in Cass City, Michigan, the 20 or 30 funerals I had, everybody poured out, and it was a kind of therapeutic 3 days. And in the city, I've just never seen that, and it may be part of time or something else. But the kind of support of institution right there.
No. I noticed that same kind of thing happening, and when I was thinking about it in the parish that I'm a part of, and I was thinking about why someone has to teach a community how to care for someone who's lost a loved one, it occurred to me that the person who taught me that was my mother, and she had been in that city her whole life. And she would say, Carol, you need to write a card to this person because so-and-so died. Or, Carol, you need to call someone. I know you don't want to, but, you know, she had enough contacts and had learned that from her mother or her father or whatever. She had all those contacts in the community, and she knew that she needed to do that, and that I needed to do that when things happened in people's lives that were important to me. Whereas now we have second generations of transients. You know, we move around all the time, and we don't have those connections, those long-term connections to people, so you have to teach them to do it with one another, even short-term, when they don't feel intimately connected to one another yet. And it's real weird to be teaching people that stuff. I mean, that's back to the same old thing, you know?
Maybe we have a new vocation here.
Teach people lost...
Even, no, teacher.
Lost tools. Recovery of lost tools. And there are many of them.
Well, I'm in a helping profession, and I'd just like to see if other people have the same kind of reaction I do. I teach religion at a church-related liberal arts college. And I chose that profession and went through 9 years of postgraduate work to get to do it. Because as an undergraduate, I had an experience, I thought, of belonging to a community. All right, so the first thing I learned, what is not important is teaching. In fact, we don't learn how to teach. And if we talk about it at all, what we learn is that we don't teach students, we teach subject material. Okay. When I finally get my long dreamed of job at the church-related small liberal arts college, I then learned that I didn't really join the college, I joined the department, and that we're all specialized. And it was my misfortune to become a freshman advisor. And this, I learned, is something that everyone most fears because it eats into your time. You never get anything published because you're talking to these freshmen who are lost. And they make stupid demands. Like, oh, one of my friends said, I just can't believe it. This woman, she walks into my office. She says, my mother has died. You're my advisor. Can you tell my other teachers that I'm going home and I won't be in class? And my friend said, I can't believe she's doing this to me. I have a PhD in history. She has no problem letting me counsel. I think you get the idea. Things like that. Or office hours is a real fun one, too. If you really want to know students, you must spend time with them, and you must be in your office. If you really want to publish, which is how you get tenure, promotion, and more money, you need to be in the library doing research, and you can't do both at once. So all the pressures that allow me to get the degree and teach in the kind of institution that I thought created community also really pushed me away from actually creating that community. So I'm wondering if other people feel the same kind of thing in religion.
Well, my 2 cents worth. Getting back to this care of the elderly people being institutionalized and this sort of thing, and how do we reverse this trend of community with the institution? My wife was in a hospital a few years back. This is shortly after this Vietnam situation and all. And there was a Vietnamese lady who was a refugee that came out of Saigon. She had been an RN over there, had been a nurse in one of the hospitals there in Saigon, but she had to get out because the threat to her, she felt it was a threat to her life and her husband because he had been in the military. And all, and she was mentioning about her first job was in a nursing home here, and all, and she mentioned that they over in Vietnam and the Asian countries they didn't have these nursing homes, and so one question led to another. I asked her how did they take care of these older people after they were too old and disabled to take care of themselves. So we're getting back to sort of the biblical sort of thing, that the eldest received the inheritance, whatever inheritance there was, But at the same time, they must accept the responsibility of taking care of his parents, or their parents, I should say. And so this is the way they work it, and as I understand, they have a closer knit family of many of the Asian countries than we do. But now, how do we reverse it here in this country? Because like so much of the cases, both parents of both a man and a wife are working in order to meet the demands of society or their economy. And so therefore, if this parent is too old and able to take care of herself, and both people are working and they're tired when they come home and the day also here again, we're getting back to this institution.
So there's another example of the invasion of institutional life.
Well, and this is the thing that I'm getting at. How do we reverse that?
Okay.
In the society and the economy, the way it's set up in our structure in our country.
The question is a good one, and this is what we got to share. Do we want to, and how do we reverse that? How do we reverse a situation where universities or colleges can no longer treat students and faculty in a communal way, and or when we don't treat the elderly? Joy.
Just an endorsement of a couple of people who've been, I think, amending your presentation, John, to include a sort of higher level the mobility factor here. And to add that I think that we're talking not only about service institutions when we talk about mobility, but virtually all of the mega institutions in our society now. I think, for instance, of the change in a city like Chicago, where you used to have, for all of their problems, a kind of ruling set of families who owned the corporate world in Chicago, right? And they were connected to the community of Chicago, and they fought Chicago, and they were Chicago for all the problems that they also had. But at the heads of those corporations now, you've got sets of managers who come through and spend 5 years in Chicago, then 5 years in LA, then 5 years in New York, then 5 years in Tokyo. And in fact, the test in Beatrice Food Company, for instance, of whether or not a guy will be promoted from junior vice president higher is that they are offered, that they are told to move for us. Right. In other words, rootedness in community is a negative factor, right?
Right?
It's an absolute negative factor in your movement up in large institutions. And that's certainly also true in universities,
right,
where your loyalty is to departments and disciplines.
So one of the contrasts you're saying is continuity and mobility mm-hmm. in these two worlds.
Mm-hmm. And that the whole society rewards mobility
yeah.
and mm-hmm. is against community.
You see that happening in the church, too. My dad has been in this parish for 32 years. And when I say that to people, it's like, oh, really?
Yeah,
5 to 10, you know, that's it. But, you know, when I think about it, there's a certain wonderful, you know, he's not stale. If he was stale, it would be too bad. But there's a certain gift that he has in being able to bury the parents of the kids who married last year, and then the next year baptize their children, and in 12 years confirm them and marry them. But we don't reward that very much. And the hard part for me is trying to figure out what prompted that kind of transience, because it's not been around for more than a generation and a half, maybe.
Mm-hmm. I know.
I'm not sure if I even know exactly how to articulate what I'm sort of thinking. I think I would say, and this relates to what you were saying about why the transiency, and what Jody was saying, I really think the major factor in loss of community is economic, and that the economic system, as it has become less, like you were talking about, local neighborhood economies, has become much less so that way, and much more of the exchange is on a national and international level. And I don't think that's the only factor. I also think, I think that both happens. I think institutions help destroy community, but I think the loss of community has also led to institutions to fill that void. So it's sort of, I don't know which comes first or whether either one did come first. But in terms of, there's another part of that, and I think it also is part of the question of how do we approach it. I don't think that the to the answer is to sort of see it as a battle against institutions, per se. I mean, I agree with a lot of what you're saying. I guess I'm concerned that we not limit the definition of community too locally. That at least one of the things that's happening that on a positive scale is that the idea of community being broader than just the sort of small town limits to that, the sort of small town mentality or just the neighborhood mentality of community is expanded. And I think that's a different kind of community, and I'm very willing to say that. But there's another way in which certain kinds of institutions are a reflection of a much broader sense of community and a much broader sense of who is my neighbor. Maybe that's another way to put it, is that the idea of neighbor, I think, needs to be seen not just in terms of the person who lives within a few miles of you. So I'm not arguing against the need for that kind of association, which has to be on a local level in one way, and that kind of grieving that we're talking about. But there's another kind of community that's also very important. I think institutions can play an extremely important role in that, so that there's a way in which reform within institutions needs to take place at the same time that we also try to find ways for communities to regroup and provide the kind of care that we've sort of given up to institutions. I don't know if that makes sense.
But you're suggesting the possibility of reforming institutions such that somehow we find or create community here. And it's not this kind of battle between two worlds.
Not entirely. I mean, I think there's part of that. But I also see, I think the economic part of it has to be taken into account. And there's a whole part of our society that, for better or worse right now, I think requires some kind of institutional intervention intervention, that's not the right word. I mean, I think that we live in a society where there are economic discrepancies that require some kind of addressing of those things that are not just simply a localized kind of problem. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. Being addressed just on a local level.
Yeah. One small example that we have in Fort Worth is that the hospitals and also on a county level, we have family counseling services which provide, for instance, emergency treatment in the home. And it's really a growing thing, and I think it's very, very well that this is coming about. And I have heard several speakers that are in that work, and they are very caring people, and they realize that the best kind of care can come in the home under the supervision of specialists.
Mm-hmm. Some would say the best you can do is stay out of this world. Give that world some resources, but don't bring your helping therapies in. And in other words, they're suggesting, who is in this other world? Women more than men, minorities. They're finding ways that, in fact, this is the only world in which minorities find leadership. They don't find women, and minorities are not finding leadership in this world, but over here they are. And a lot of people are doing a lot of good things in this world, quite apart from our institution. Now, often we look and say, my goodness, look at 63rd Street. We need to, and so we populated 63rd Street with all the branch office agencies from this world in order to bring these institutions into the places where we saw them most needed. We continue to create the desert.
You said bring, stay out of that world, but bring them the resources that they need. How do you do that?
Give back the resources we've stolen, probably, rather than bring them.
Yeah.
In other words, in this theory, we've slowly usurped.
But you've only usurped because of the economy, because both the husband and wife have to work. And who was it that was keeping up the community action? Who was taking care of the bereavement? Who was being the neighbor in the morning, listening to the wife talk about what was happening to her and her children? Who were the ones who were getting the children off to work, to school? Who were the ones who were making sure that Mother Jones over there was being taken care of? It was that wife that was able to stay home and not have to work and have two incomes. And so what has happened with these institutions is we have these care services who are employing the wives who used to stay home in the communities, so they go get a job, and then they come back into the community and are paid for what they were doing, you know, for free, and feeling good about it, and volunteering.
But, you know, I think a part of what's going on there is that it's even bigger maybe than the economic issue is that the communities that I see that have fallen apart and are falling apart are communities that no longer have control of their own stories. And they don't know, they don't have a story to tell to the next generation, and they can't think about the stories that preceded them. And there was a way in which those wives that stayed home, whether they were men or women, those wives that stayed home, could tell the stories and pass it on. So you learn how to help people in their grief. You learn how not to worry about your baby when they threw up, because babies just do that. And you know what I mean? We don't have that kind of process of passing on stories. And I think a big part of that is that we have so devalued stories within the last two generations that science has been what's important and stories have not. Mm-hmm. And so we've completely lost our reverence for stories and our understanding of their power. And all that has just made us terribly, terribly sterile and has incapacitated us, I think, made us very impotent as human beings.
Mm-hmm. And the only person you tell your story to now is your therapist.
Right!
Tell me your story. Okay, here's my story.
And that feels so good, and that's what we think. They're our friends. And
we see too much conflict between institutions and communities. And actually, one institution that promotes community is the church.
Yes.
And we can come up with all sorts of excuses why we can't be in community, like everybody's working and doing this and doing that. But you can create communities in your own neighborhood. Nobody says you can't have an open house, or you can't have a picnic, or you can't get along with your neighbors. There's nobody says you can't create communities in your own church communities. There's nobody says you can't do volunteer work and be a part of that community. And we can't blame Standard Oil if we fail to be part of the community.
Yeah. Well, see, now we're at the point, we're so into this institutional world that the task of maybe on a Sunday afternoon or some other things, creating community becomes a special task that we sort of have to give our attention to because it no longer really exists and we miss it. The question raises, how do we begin to recover some of the tools that we've lost?
Yeah. Don't you think perhaps, though, these institutions are becoming communities in themselves? Rather than being geographically located, their institution.
Take any one of them. Take a university, or take a hospital, or take... What would be the characteristics in any of them that you would identify as parts of community? I don't see many of them.
Might be communities with the little C, this is where you spend most of your time and expend most of your energy.
There's a kind of
being creative or supportive.
But you have, a lot of the guys at the office have lunch together, or they go out and golf on Wednesday morning. There's the kind of camaraderie of business.
I think what we might be thinking of is the definition of community is changing. It previously was a community, a place that people near us formed a group, and certainly that does still exist in some places. But I know, like in where I live, semi-rural area in Washington, our communities are made up of like sports, soccer, education, because of schools. We don't know our neighbors that well. We know better the people all across town because of these sort of things. And I think, whether we like it or not, the form of it is changing. And that may not necessarily, and that's just reality. But I think what has to be retained is the substance, if there still is this linkage. And how do we maintain that in some way, rather than wanting to go back to what we had? It may not be possible with our lives, for some of us.
Mm-hmm. You were going to say something earlier.
I was going to say a bunch of things, but it seems that, but I can't remember the first 10. So I'll just give you the last one that was in response to that, was that, you know, yes, I don't think in anywhere here that there is implicit in what John's saying, or if it is, then I would disagree with him, that it's a question of going back, you know, to the good old days when everybody was in the neighborhood streets and all the bubbas were, you know, beating their laundry in the backyard. But, and so community may not be a community of place, arbitrary community of place anymore, but it still is community of choice, I think. And that choice is related to place in some ways. I mean, and I'm thinking of the community, a neighborhood that I live in, where people have, it has a certain amount of transience. All urban neighborhoods have this amount of transience, but there's a core of people who have chosen to stay there to build community, and have made exerted an effort in terms of, therefore, if we are going to stay here and we're going to build a community, then we've got to get involved in our schools. Okay, we're going to do schoolwork. And then we're going to stay in this community, and boy, there's some rotten housing in this community, so we're going to start working on housing. And we're going to do that. And what has happened is that other people coming in just transiently or hear about it, that people are now moving to this community because they hear that it's a community that's trying to build community. And so that it's still possible to have that sort of bubba in the backyard feeling within a sort of a 20th century highly mobile context with all of these problems, but it really does require what John's describing here. That it's associational, and it is that other world. And and people in my community have had big fights with institutions precisely over that. So it's, you know, I mean, it's not just a matter of, well, the plow and the small town is gone, and so we can't get it back, and we have to now live in this other sort of hypertech, and service-related context. I think that there is a way that you can still take what's best of that and do it, because I've seen it happen.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of us are losing this. I mean, we're finding in these institutions little nooks of satisfaction, and we're getting along, and we're making do, and we're losing memory. Mm-hmm.
I really agree with what Susan was saying, because I think the kind of community that you were talking about when you know somebody across town, and what I've experienced a lot of times in my life is my life is compartmentalized. You know, I have quote-unquote community with a group of people that I do one activity with. I have another community with another group of people that I know through other activities. And I have another group over here. But I think that only when there is a sense of some kind of place do people care about the whole of life for a group of people. Mm-hmm. And if that's the kind of stuff that I hear you talking about. Mm-hmm. And I guess what I would say in answer to your question about what are things we have to do to get some of that, maybe not get back to it, but try to refocus that. Again, I come back to economic stuff, and I think that the driving motivation for most people around the concepts that we have about what success is and what is important in the United States is job and family, or maybe not even the family, but there's not anything in between. And so that there's not that sense of caring beyond the bounds of your lot on your house or your apartment building. There's not that sense of wholeness about the whole of life and the different dimensions of that. And I think that requires people reshaping priorities about their lives, and that they're going to start making choices around jobs that are not necessarily the one that's going to promote me the fastest and pay me the most, but perhaps that the place is important, what that means in terms of the way I use my time, with my family, with my, how intentionally I'm going to go about being part of the community, and where is that, the whole sense of volunteerism, I mean, that's sort of a sense of something's being lost, people want to be paid for everything. Those kinds of things, I think, are what really has to happen.
Joe, do you want
to... Just one part of the story that I think is fascinating to me and people might be interested in, this is what John has just done in the last couple of days, and will continue tomorrow, is a sort of, it's part of a conversation we've been having in Chicago, I think, for about 15 years, trying to understand what is happening to the city, and what's happening to neighborhoods, and particularly poor neighborhoods in the city. One of the interesting things about this particular strand of our conversation that John's been leading us in here has to do with the reception this kind of line gets. This is a line that's still getting sort of invented as we go here. When it's presented to the very people of whom it is most critical. John and I both have experiences, but John McKnight, I think, has a lot more. Talking to audiences of 500 or 1,000 social workers. And this is an analysis which absolutely is devastating for social workers. It tells them that their entire lives are arid, right? Virtually meaningless, right? And that they are not only not doing any good, but they really are doing harm. And our colleague McKnight is actually stronger on that than John has been tonight. But almost inevitably, at the end of this devastating indictment of their entire lives, 500 to 1,000 people get up and applaud wildly. I mean, that's interesting. That's real. Something in this resonates with the experience of the people who are in this world. Something about it clearly connects with lots of folks. And that makes me want to take this line of analysis even more serious than it seems to be.
Right, and I think it's that line that when McKnight says, in the inevitable failure of the service, the bereavement counselor will find the desert even in himself, which indicates the awareness that what one has been spending one's time, at least in social work, in trying to help precisely this other world, that one has been robbing that other world of capacity. And it's in that awareness that I think a lot of us in the helping profession have to get up. Well, tomorrow, let's begin to ask, and under the title, Can Helping Professionals Be Saved? I'm less concerned with that than I am with this other world here. What can we do as helping professionals, either some concern within these institutions or within this other world? How do we keep our feet in both worlds and begin to think critically about our vocations? So we'll deal with that tomorrow morning for an hour.